You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Lisa Hoke, who is an artist living in New York City and currently represented by Elizabeth Harris Gallery. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
So, Lisa, tell us a little bit about what it is that you're working on right now. What's happening in your studio at the moment?
Well, right now I'm working on three projects that are coming up really quickly. Tomorrow I start building a small version of a piece at the Pratt Manhattan Gallery that comes from a show in North Carolina at the museum in Raleigh that Linda Daugherty curated called Zero to 60. And I especially love this group show because it's about the way that time filters through different artists' work in different ways. Like there's a piece by Paul Chan, Do Ho So. So this is a version that Pratt is doing of that show, and I'm going to build a piece tomorrow. And then after that, in a few weeks, I go out to the museum in Oklahoma City and build the largest piece I've ever done. It's 150-foot linear installation, and then I go to Sarasota, Florida, and this one is even funnier in that it's an old schoolhouse that they've bought to convert into a museum, and they're raising funds to make the museum, and it'll be the Sarasota Museum of Contemporary Art, and they're collecting all my material for me so that I will arrive, and then I'll just work with whoever's around cutting and pasting and making a piece, and I've never done anything like that. So that I'm looking forward to it in a very nervous way. But mm-hmm. So that's what I'm working on right now.
And will that look something like recent projects or murals like Love American Style?
Yes. I've been, the recycled cardboard, the colored cardboard that I've been collecting, it sort of just expanded. I got, there's this fabulous old candy store in the Lower East Side, Economy Candy. It's just
filling. That one. An amazing store.
Amazing store.
There's nothing like it in the world, you know.
And it feels so fabulous when you go in because everything you've ever remembered is in there and things you don't know. And they agreed to save all their colored packaging for me. So I go over there once a week and I get these giant garbage bags and carry them home. And so I've really, as I've worked with this material, it's changed in a way. And then the super and in our building collects and saves everything for me. My sister saves. So what's been fascinating for me is it's moved from a really formal material to one that holds a lot more meaning for me. In some ways, I call it a sort of horror and love affair because the sheer number of boxes that I get on a daily basis on packaging and packaging that everything comes in is it's scary that we use this much, that what's so disposable is so beautiful at the same time. So the murals I'm going to be building will be I've called it a regurgitated mirror of what I see when I go into a store or into, almost any place, like grocery store, shoe store, clothing store, anywhere. And it's become more surprising to me, it's become more of a subject matter than strictly a formal use of color and movement. And I just can't deny that the excess, and I'm a person who loves excess and works in a really slow, progressive way that excess usually is the result of the way I work. But so I feel as though it's a kind of commentary on that excess, and it's a mixed commentary because I think what comes out accentuates that incredible design, color, and packaging that we have at our disposal. And so the things I'm working on now do inhabit that same vocabulary that I've been working with the last couple of years.
That makes sense, and it also does seem daunting to see that amount of cardboard, of refuse coming in, because you realize you're just seeing a fraction of it, and that means there's just an almost impossible amount to imagine that's going into dumps every day.
Impossible, and also to find that, you know, I walk down the street now on recycling day when the bags are all clear on the New York street, and it's all I can do to refrain from opening up, which I have done, open up these bags and pulling things out. And so I'm horrified at how much there is, but oh my God, as a material to cut up and use, I found gold, because it's all free. It's the only thing I'm buying are X-Acto blades and glue gun sticks, you know?
Right. So let's go back a little bit now. That's very exciting. What were your beginnings in art? What do you think first got you involved in art, or what comes to mind when I ask that?
I have a fairly unusual relationship with it, in that I graduated from college with a degree in English literature, and then had this profound moment where I thought, gosh, you know, this, I really, I wonder what art school is. I was really just curious to find out. And I grew up as a Navy brat up and down the South, and so in Virginia, in state, I could go and get another degree very cheaply, and I went to VCU, and you know, this is before you had to have portfolios, and this was 1975, and basically, I said, I just really want to do this, and I have no idea what this is, because I don't draw, I've never drawn, I've never painted, I have no idea what this is, but there's something about it that's mysterious. That's why I love the name of your program. Because I wanted to demystify, what is this thing that you're supposed to go to art school and learn? And so they said, sure, come. So I got my BFA and then went to graduate school and quit graduate school.
But before you go to get your BFA, why? I mean, I understand, of course, the attraction to art and the arts and everything, but why? I mean, was there any precedent or art that you had seen that made you think, oh, that's so interesting? What even brought you to that?
You know, that I wish there had been. I had seen some weavings. You know, it's 1975, and I was living in North Carolina where I had gone to school, and a lot of people were working with sort of, you know, found materials, and I had seen this woman weave with sticks and stuff, and I thought, well, that's pretty fascinating. And why I made the leap, I really don't know. I have no idea. And to this day, it's one of the stranger things that, except that I knew that it wasn't craft that I was interested in. When I saw it, I wanted to know more about, like, what's that creative process behind that? It was really that simple. And I looked at what could I afford. I could afford in-state, and the one school, VCU, had an art school. And, you know, what I thought was that perhaps art was just coming up with a problem and solving it. And oddly, I think that's what I've always done, is that I decided that's what art was, and it really never became anything more than that. And that was enough to sustain a life for me.
That's a fascinating thought. But then, so after you got a degree in English literature, you got another undergraduate degree in art?
Right, a BFA then.
Okay.
Yeah, they didn't take any humanities.
Right. and so during that process, you're kind of finding your medium. Like, what happened during your BFA? How did it suddenly seem like, wow, this is exciting?
I took drawing classes and painting classes. I was a disaster. But I went into the sculpture department, and it was like home. I loved that it was, and they had a great sculpture department that was in an old car showroom. And, you know, it just, these, I just have found that every time I move through my life, I recognize at the very moment this is the right place to be. And it was like one of those buildings I walked in. I loved what I saw out of the corner of my eye. I felt the space, and I thought, this is it. I'm going to make sculpture. Whatever sculpture is, I'm going to make it. You know, I still think of myself as making sculpture, even though I've moved to the wall.
So what happened after your BFA? You get out of undergraduate school. Where was undergraduate school?
That was VCU, and University of North Carolina, Greensboro was my English literature program degree there. And then I went to VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And then I was trying to decide. I was going to go to the Chicago Art Institute, and all set to go. And then I met Jim Roche, who was a real oddball guy. He'd been in a Whitney Biennial. He lived in rural Florida, and he had a very, very strange persona and also a great sense of humor. And I thought, well, I'm going to go to Florida State and work with Jim Roche, because I know what's going to happen to me if I go to Chicago. I'll never leave Chicago, but if I go to Florida, I know I'll leave there. So I went to Florida, and one of the things that happened in Florida was that one of the visiting artists there was Nancy Rubens. And Nancy was the first ferocious woman I ever met. I mean that only in a positive way, in that as an artist, she lived and breathed what she was making. And that was my first experience with seeing that kind of energy that's so visceral that I always thought that move to Florida was the smartest thing I could have done. Now, I left there, dropped out of the program, and moved with about four or five people to New York during the middle of my second semester there. It was like New York or more Florida, and definitely New York felt more exciting. This was 1980. And so I moved to New York and decided that...
Okay,
yeah.
And decided that you want to be an artist somehow in New York.
I wanted to be an artist. I didn't want to get a master's degree. I figured whatever there was in life to learn about art, I was going to learn it in New York. And I would learn it with more intensity.
And did you get a second job when you were working in New York?
When I got to New York, I was a waitress.
Okay, where were you waitressing?
The 1/5. And, you know, what was really, really critical about New York, and this is one of the things that I think, and I've always said to students, and it's harder and harder to do now. When I got to New York, we stayed with some people on the edge of Soho, and Soho was quickly going, you know, by 1980. But we looked out of the window, and we saw a for rent sign on this building that I'm in right now, and scraped together every dime from every relative, aunt, uncle, cousin, to put the key fee down to go into a building without any heat or running water, and to basically move in. But I came into this loft.
But you were renting or you were buying the building?
No renting, but you had to pay like $1,000 key fee to like some guy on the second floor, and that's the only way you were going to get your lease.
Right.
And so you had to come up with that, and, you know, it wasn't a lot, but, I think as I remember, we had to come up with about $5,000 because we had to build the whole place out. And but I walked in this place and said, that's it. I am never moving out of this building. And that was 34 years ago.
Wow, and you're still renting in that space.
No, we got it out of foreclosure. We hired a lawyer. We had a lawyer here for 20 years who found a loophole and helped us buy it. All the artists here, we bought our spaces.
And, oh, so it's an AIR kind of building?
Well, it's it's even a crazier story. We bought it out of the Resolution Trust that Clinton formed to get rid of federal property after the savings and loan catastrophe when they were holding all this property. And so we found a developer, and the developer put down 70% of the money, and there were 10 artists, and we only had to put down the 30% for our share. So we bought, and then he turned it into a luxury condominium. So all the artists, we all live in here in a luxury condominium.
Wow.
Crazy.
When you first moved in the 80s, where did you have your first show, and how did that come about?
Well, you know, first show I think was Ned Rifkin was at the New Museum, and he started to, I think they had just opened the space downtown, it might have been 84, Artist Space. I did a show at Artist Space, and then Ned Rifkin curated a show with, I think it was Amy Solman and me and Michael Byron in the lobby of the New Museum. And then after that, I did a show with Rosa Esmond, and I started being represented by her.
And then how did that happen? Because that's just an interesting, I mean, just that in itself in terms of, you know, you're an artist from the South, from Florida,
right.
You're in New York.
Right. How do you...
How did that just pop up with Ned Rifkin and then the gallery?
You know, I wish I could say, I mean, this is the part of your show that I think is so fascinating, is that the art world has that layer of mystery in how things happen. And, of course, I could have recounted it more clearly, you know, 30 years ago than I can now, but it all was about that, you know, as a young artist, I threw myself into every opening, meeting everybody. All my friends had friends, and art was just all we thought about. It was all we did, eat, drank, argued about it. So it was really easy to meet people in the art world, like, you know, we didn't even call it the art world. It wasn't really a world. It was just a very small group of people. So my boyfriend knew somebody who then must have known, and I think the first thing was Valerie Smith at Artist Space when she was first down there. And I think we met at a dinner, you know, one of those dinners at, Magoo's. Where you said to people, hey, would you want to come over and see what I'm working on? And it was a lot more informal when people would come over. Also, I had a boyfriend at the time, and I didn't hesitate when he had somebody come over for me to say, oh, will you look at my work, which is like really an annoying thing to do. But you get as many rejections as successes, and that's the thing that was the hardest lesson to learn, I think. When you're that excited and you're that ready, and the things that work out are great, but there are twice as many things that don't happen. And I think if I look back over the years, it's learning how to live with those disappointments and failures and just wrap them into the successes and the things that go well. Years ago, I got a review that really made me unhappy, and I had run into this man, Benny Andrews, a painter, and I was complaining to Benny, and he said, Lisa, you're not going to ever be okay unless the positive feedback and the negative feedback are equal. And I thought, oh, God, Benny, that's never going to happen. But slowly over the years, that has happened, in that there's an equal weight that takes away a lot of that horror of those early years.
You're still waitressing, you're represented
right.
by a gallery.
I work starts to sell. I never teach. It's just something I just didn't do. I love traveling, being a visiting artist, but it's just it's not what I do. AD Gallery started to carry these cast iron bookends that I've been making. I've been going out in the 80s with some of the guys out to these amazing iron foundries out in Paterson, New Jersey. And I was really intimidated about trying to cast. Here's Gene Heistein out there casting things that weigh, you know, 4 tons. And my friend Wynn Knowlton took me out, and he's making really impressive things. And I didn't know what to take out, so I took a coconut with me one day. Well, it turns out the mold maker was a gardener, and he started casting vegetables for me and sending them to me, and all of that work came out of this cast iron foundry work. And I'd get these boxes of cast iron pieces of fruit that would cost me about $75. And so I did a series of cast iron bookends, and AD Gallery started to sell them, and they were really... For a decade, that was my bread and butter. And
So that was really what enabled you to stop. To stop waitressing, and that
stop
and,
waitressing.
And those bookends were kind of a production item for you.
They were a production item, and when we built the loft, we built a rental apartment, so I had almost no rent for the first 20 years in New York. And then my future husband, who lives here with me now, once he was part of the scene, then there were two of us, and it was just, it got easier. But I've always thought that what really helps is to have a bigger space divided up either with friends or to rent out a space. And that's what really made it possible for me, because living in New York, as crazy as it was costing me almost nothing.
Amazing. So now for the next 10 years, we're in the '90s now. You're living off those bookends
and then selling
more work.
And then you know, things really started to change in the art world, and this is the time I love in the art world, because every woman I know, and I was part of a group of 60 women in 1991, and we went to each other's studio constantly. And what started to really happen was that women started to recommend each other for things. And all of a sudden, we were all in shows. We were showing, and things were not so hard. And it was an amazing time. And at that time also, I got married, had a baby, and decided that I was going to do it. You know, there's just no reason that this whole thing about that I couldn't do every part of this, that I could have a family, I could keep making my work. There was just no reason that couldn't happen. And I'm very stubborn, and it worked perfectly. And in the early 90s, thread waxing space opened. I left Rosa Esmond and did a show there at thread waxing. And that was a really exciting time where it was like New York was just the work that was being shown. I did a show with Leonardo Drew and Brad Kallhammer, and then went on to show with the small gallery Hrodner Romley. And Stuart Hrodner was just a great person to have as a dealer and best friend. And after that, I showed with Holly Solomon. And when she died, I was lucky enough to move over to Elizabeth Harris. So I've always worked with galleries that have let me just be who I am and make what I want.
The bookends continued to sell, or that stopped at some point?
They did, and then Elizabeth kind of closed AD. And at that time, the editions had started to run out, so I just closed it down.
Okay, so that brings us up to the present. So then you're at Elizabeth Harris. Did that change how you worked working with Elizabeth Harris?
No, it really didn't. She's always been incredibly generous. With all the people I've worked with, every time I change my work a lot, I'm always restless and moving, and there are bodies of work that I do that I don't think are as successful. And I look back, I got into a kind of performative installation that meant I'd build the piece and then I wouldn't even see it until it was built, which is kind of a nightmare for me that I do that. And Elizabeth has been incredibly supportive about the good ones and the bad ones. And in a way, in the last few years, I've sort of taken back the way I build them now. I build elements more intimately in my studio, so I have a studio time, and then they multiply when I get out on site. Like the Oklahoma City is three different shows that are coming down that are all being shipped there, and I'll make something totally new out of them. But the elements are elements that I've known, and each collage has been made individually. And so I have found a way to have it sort of personal and then grow from a small scale to a huge scale with my hands still in it. It doesn't mean that I know what I'm going to build, but...
Right. So now you're, you know, I mean, very much a career artist. This is how you make your living. Working with Elizabeth Harris alone, just with her, that's enough to sustain your practice as an artist and make a living?
Well, I get paid now by a lot of museums to come build pieces, oddly enough. That's more how I make money than selling pieces.
But is that orchestrated by yourself, or does Elizabeth Harris do that? Or?
No, I orchestrate it, and Elizabeth keeps up with what I'm doing.
So how do you orchestrate that? Is it do you ever give proposals to museums, or they're simply knocking on your door all the time?
Well, you know, now they are contacting me, but 6 years ago, I was invited to do a proposal for the New Britain Museum, and it would be funded by the Edwin Austin Fellowship that National Academy has. I never knew about this. They had this fellowship, and they asked if I'd do a proposal, and there were four or five other artists that did proposals, and I was awarded this, and it was a fabulous opportunity because there was this big hunk of money from the National Academy Museum that went to build a big piece at the New Britain Museum in the Solowitz staircase that Solowitz estate had established the funding for this. So it was this amazing chance. And it was a piece that the scaffolding I used was three stories tall, and it was the biggest piece I'd ever built. And it gave me a lot of self-confidence, and it was a very exciting moment. And since then, I haven't had to do proposals. I'll have people call and say, we're thinking about asking you to do something. And I'll say, okay, well... I'll do it.
but they must have seen the, you know, installations in other places and know that museum.
Right. So that's all I can do is say, well, look at this one, and I'll build you something, but that's the last thing I built. So like Oklahoma City, we're going to try something with the brochure where I build it, and we're going to photograph it and drop it into a brochure in 24 hours because I'm always – in my catalogs and brochures, it's always what I built before because what I'm building then doesn't exist until I build it. But you know what I have found, and I think this is the magical part about the art world, is that I've found that there's this tremendous ability for people to say yes to something as an idea that I never would have expected them to do. I never would have expected that Oklahoma City Museum would say, sure, we're going to trust that you're going to come out here and build this piece based on just having a conversation with you. And that kind of trust in artists and artwork and the kind of financial commitment, and the McNay Museum did this for me, and these small museums are really tremendous these days in what they're helping artists accumulate and accomplish and the way they're bringing their community in. And it's a huge trust. It's not like they're bringing in shows that have already been, boxed up and sent.
Right, they're taking a gamble. They're taking a true gamble.
A real gamble, and I'm deeply appreciative. Always nervous I'm going to disappoint them. I'm amazed also that as an artist that you can ask people to have faith in you, and they do.
So let me conclude with this. That's fascinating and true and a very important point, I think, that kind of belief. A lot of artists are listening to this, as well as students from a variety of places around the world. It's certainly not just Yale. It's people who live in the Midwest, to New Yorkers, artists everywhere. They're listening to this, and some of them are thinking, but she lived in this time and had this studio, and they're struggling in different ways. Is there anything you want to say to those artists and how, and anything that you think would be helpful to them in any way?
Well, the only thing I can say is that there's no reason why what I wanted to do would come true. I mean, there was no earthly reason this should have worked out except pure desire, that it wasn't about natural, talent, ability, or, you can always look back and say, well, that was a great time and there was a lot available then, and that's absolutely true. I think this is this is a different time, but I think it's still the same in that it has to do with determination and optimism and the love of what you do. And one thing I really do think is true, whether it's the scariest person in a museum or your neighbor, is that people actually can tell when what you do is meaningful to you, because that's the only thing we have control over. I mean, and I think trying to figure out what the art world wants, what it needs, what could sell, is a disaster, and it's a sure way to be the most unhappy artist possible. But that if you can generate this peculiar thing that makes your heart beat, it's going to make somebody else's heart beat.
Lisa, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, my pleasure. I really appreciate you calling. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.